session 276B1, Reflections on the 40th Anniversary of the Priesthood Restoration. Our panelist presenter today is Misha McGriggs. She's earned a PhD in counseling psychology from BYU and works as a postdoctoral fellow at Columbia University. Her fellowship is focused on the somatic embodiment of the trauma of racism and oppression. Her latest publications can be found in Teen Vogue, Decolonizing Mormonism, and Lift Where You Stand. Stand where your mom is at? Lift where you stand. It's something. All right. Misha would like, do you want?
Yeah, so.
She's a therapist, I'm sorry.
We are going to do something a little different. And we're going to circle up. Can we do that, especially since we're in the
middle? Can we circle up? That's what we're going to do. We're going to move our chairs into a circle, kind of like it's group therapy. So it won't be group therapy, but we're going to circle up. So if we could get in a big circle, that'd be awesome. First, I'm going to apologize for my voice. I'm losing it. I think I'm allergic to Utah. Every time I come back, I get sick. So so I apologize for my scratchy voice.
Where do you?
I live in New York City. I live in Harlem. And it's lovely. Sylvia's? I love Sylvia's. So I'm going to grab the door. Everyone's going, we're going to talk about the priesthood, and there's going to be a special panel of guests, and that was the plan.
I was thinking we're getting ready for a boxing.
What's that?
Were we going to get Lester Bush somewhere?
He's tomorrow. Yeah, he's tomorrow. So, Lindsay asked me, a long time ago, probably 6 months ago, she asked me to organize a panel about the priesthood ban. And I said, great, awesome, I'll get right on it, I'll put together a panel, it'll be great. And then something happened in our community. Something happened, and when this thing happened, I had to call Lindsay and I had to say, I can't organize this panel. I can't ask my black friends to show up in this white space and give of themselves to celebrate because there was a violation that happened in the community. And she said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I think I want to talk about what happened and why it was a problem. And I want us to be able to start to look at ourselves as opposed to looking at the church and start to look at ourselves, at how we have contributed to oppression. And so I said, that's what I can do, because I think it's an elephant in the room. And I'm one of the very few, say, Spriggs and I, right, are like two of the very few people who continue to engage with the progressive Mormon community, two black people who continue to engage. Because these types of things keep happening. And I asked Amanda to be here with me to kind of team up with me and support me as we did this because it's hard. And I think that she and I have conversations about race a lot, and arguments and conversations and all sorts of things, and I kind of wanted her to help me facilitate a conversation. So, if you don't know what I'm talking about yet, I'm just going to get out there and talk about what the violation was and what happened. What was the wound? So, there was, I'll just read a portion of it. I have it pulled up. This is from President Nelson. I offer a full, unqualified apology for the air of racism which was taught from this office and in the tabernacle and over the pulpits of our churches. He didn't. Right. So, he didn't say that. So there was an entire statement that was very, very, very long and very detailed and showed up as a... How many people know about this? Okay, so most of us know about this.
So to kind of... To fill this... To fill this in, what she's reading from is a statement that was released the day that the church was saying that they're going to have a newsroom statement. And it was released on a website that looked as if it were the actual newsroom. It had the right font. The web address was similar but not exactly the same. And it even had some links to go to the real newsroom. So if you actually tried to click, you would go to the real newsroom. But the actual article itself was not from the newsroom, not from the church, not from the leaders. And so for a period of several hours in this day, because everyone was expecting an announcement from the church, this is what we had. And so I'll go ahead.
Yeah, so this rolls out, right? And people are like, What is happening? This is the day we have prayed for. This is that blessing that we've been begging for. And it was a moment of healing. And then we found out that it didn't come from the church. It came from our community, the progressive Mormon community, the ex-Mormon community, the Big Tent Mormon community. The Sunstone community. It came from us. And the aftermath, well, first of all, before the aftermath, it was, when it was turned out to be fake, the response overwhelmingly that I saw and other black people saw from our white brothers and sisters was that it was funny. It was good. Show the church that's what the church should be saying. So the church wrote it. This is what you should say, church. Someone had to say it. And it wasn't good, and it wasn't funny. And the fact that people missed that was traumatizing for black Mormons. Yes.
Okay. I've heard all about it, but who actually did put it out?
It was Yeah, they have. And his name's Johnson.
Jonathan Streeter.
Is his name. His name's John something. Right. He speaks for himself. No. But the people that shared it, right, that shared it, who thought it was so great, who thought it was wonderful, and completely missed how traumatizing it was for black people.
I can't imagine anyone that would think that would be a funny thing.
Yeah, a lot of people did, unfortunately. A lot of people did.
Sick people.
Yeah, and or not, or just regular folks. And I wanted to us to be able to have a conversation with, what can each of us do? Why was this a problem? What can each of us do? Because I think that oftentimes, the progressive community, the ex-Mormon community, will say, ask black people, how do you want to stay in a church that's racist? Well, newsflash, everywhere is racist for black people because we live in an imperialist, white supremacist world. And so there's nowhere that we can go that's not racist. Where people find themselves and their spiritual homes is everyone's personal, individual journey, right? And the focus is oftentimes on the church is so bad, the church is so bad, the church is so racist. And true, right? But the church is the people. We make up the church. And we make up the Mormon community. And we have got to be accountable to one another. And so it's most of my Black friends and colleagues who are Mormon have less problems with the conservatives and more problems with the liberals. Because the liberals like to say, we are on the side of progress, of social justice. Like to talk the talk, but don't walk the walk, right? And so when you say that you've got the answers, just like the church, right? The church says, we have the answers. That's why people are so upset that isn't the church supposed to be perfect and have the answers of God, right? And so the church proclaims to have the answers. And then how can they do this if they're really the true church? How can we, if we have the real true values, do this, right? So I want us to be able to really look at ourselves and say, how can I, where are the ways in which that I've been oppressive? Why was this such an error? And how do I avoid it moving forward? How do I not, if my first reaction is to think, oh yeah, well, that was a good idea, or that was funny, or that was needed, or whatever, all things that I heard, how do we start to go, maybe there's more to this story, and what else can I learn? Yes.
Can I ask you, and you don't have to if it's too traumatizing, but can I ask both of you to kind of give us like your short synopsis timeline of when you got it, what reactions were, and maybe as you like saw people reacting the ways that you saw them, what your initial reactions were to that, so that we can kind of get a timeline and then we can go from there.
Sure. Right, right. So, yes. So I've really taken, even though I'm writing, I guess, a lot, I've taken a step back in recent months from my kind of like online interactions. And so I had been off of Facebook for months, and I happened to get on Facebook, and it was blowing up. There's the church issued an apology. The church issued an apology. So I'm like, okay, let me go look at this. And I'm reading it. And I was like, no way, this isn't real. Like, this didn't come to the church. Like, that was my reaction. My first thought was, they're not going to say that. They're not. This, like, I need some extra, I need to see the prophet holding it like this before I'm going to believe it. I got it a little late, so within an hour, it had come out that it was fake. And I was like, okay. And I was hurt, but I'm also not super active in the church. I'm not at church every week. I'm not going to the temple every month. I'm not living an active Mormon, traditional Mormon lifestyle in a lot of ways. And so things that hurt me, it's not as bad for me. But what I saw, but I knew it was going to be bad, because what I saw within the hour of it being, fake, were my friends, my brothers and my sisters, the people that have taken care of me, devastated, because they thought they were finally seen. They thought they were finally heard by the church that they so love and are so dedicated to. Church that they've spent their life defending, not just to the outside world, but to their own Black community. Because for Black people, every single thing that we do either connects us to community or disconnects us. When you choose to join a church that has a racist history, that it does, you move yourself away from the Black community. You take a step back, right? Now, everything that you do, other things that you're connected to the community. You share culture, you share music, you share family. Those things stay. But moving into a white church that has such a problematic history disconnects you. So black Mormons have to defend their Mormonism to black people all of the time. All of the time. And they have to defend their blackness to Mormons all of the time. And I was going to play some of Zandra's response, and maybe that might be helpful. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Sisters in Zion, but Zandra Rains put her response to the fake apology on. It was grief, folks, like grief, that someone would do this, that someone would fake this thing. It's like the one thing that the one thing that you've been looking for to revive you, for the church to atone, because we've been holding the church's feet to the fire and saying, please atone, please come correct and atone. You ask us to repent, you need to repent. And we thought we got that, and we didn't. What we got was a joke. We got a joke. And the church didn't look stupid. It was us. It was black Mormons who looked stupid. We looked naive, we looked dumb, and again, we were having to defend. And they're like, damn, even these Mormons are going to give you a fake apology? We're like, whoa. So then again, they have to go back to their black community and say, and why are you here again? Why do you continue to go to this community that will hurt you time and time again? So I'm watching, I'm in community, right? I'm calling people, I'm listening to people crying, I'm talking to people. So that's going on. So then within an hour, this is all within a few hours. And then all of the kind of responses from non-black people start coming in. So, and those what are some of the things that you all saw from other white friends? Some accountability would be good, I think, over what you saw. Amanda, what did you see?
I saw people saying, like, it's so good to show what the church should have done. This highlights how far away from, like, what really needs to be said and where they're standing. Because it was the same time that they were meeting with the leaders of the NAACP. And so that's why everybody was kind of waiting for this announcement. And so a lot of it was like, look at how we shined a light on this situation and how far away the church, we really showed the church how far away they are from where they're supposed to be.
I want to bounce off of that. Look at how
this idea was, look at how we shined a light on what the church has done. And it was this profound ignorance on behalf of, I mean, I don't want to put race to it, but it's basically on behalf of white Mormons, of thinking that but for this hoax, no one had been addressing the issue before. And so people would say things like, well, black Mormons should be mad at the church, as if there isn't already a huge sense of tension even from faithful black Mormons. I mean, me, I'm like, you know, ex-Mormon, I'm like, I was like, Misha, I'm like, I don't trust this. But I saw people who were faithful and who had tears of joy that turned into tears of sourness within an hour. And then people had the nerve to say, you should be mad at the church. Why are you blaming us, the messenger, for pointing out that the church is harmful to you? As if they didn't already know this. And so the main thing that happened in the ensuing discussions in all of these groups was trying to convince people that this hoax was not something that the church did. This hoax was solely the community. Jonathan Streeter, the ex-Mormon, I mean, I don't think that he says that he's trying to, you know, do things and trying to help out and whatever, but I mean, I...
So he is actually an ex-Mormon?
I am pretty sure that he's ex-Mormon. He's not, you know...
Definitely not in the Council of 12.
Yeah.
But what he did was he also communicated with other people before he was doing this to say, okay, I need people who can kind of share this around. And there are also other big names in the community. I don't know if we're going to go there because it kind of does, you know, call into question some people who now they would say, well, I didn't really know what was going on. It's kind of like, why are you pushing this forward? And this idea is, he kind of made some apologies later on, but for the first several hours, he was adamant to say, I'm just trying to push the church forward, and no one else is doing what needs to be done. And so this idea of ignorance, it goes two ways. One, it's ignorance of the real experience of people of color in the church, and Black Mormons specifically in the church, and it's also ignorance of what these communities are already doing. It's like, Black Mormons aren't just sitting around, you know. It's not like people aren't trying to push the church forward. Like, Genesis has been a thing for a while, and a lot of people probably aren't involved in that, but it's been a thing for a while. And just because the things that, you know, people of color do in the church, or to use some other examples, the things that feminists may do, or the things that LGBT people may do to try to move the envelope forward, aren't as flashy or radical as people might think. That doesn't mean that people aren't trying to push for change. But there was this idea that you have to really stick it to the church and burn it down, and if there's collateral damage, that's okay. And the collateral damage was the black community. And so it's kind of like there's this thing that I experienced in trying to talk with several people after this, where they would say, well, we're sorry that people felt traumatized, but that wasn't the intention. Like, you have to either be ignorant of how your actions come across or just callous to think that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that when we really look at what's underneath that, right, what lies behind that mentality is this idea that this entire group of individuals who have been faithful, who have been activists, who have done all of this thing, like, they just don't know better, right? Because I know better. I know what needs to happen. Like, you silly little people over there, I'm going to tell you what you need. And I think that, like, really, that's what's behind that kind of action. Otherwise, like, there's zero respect for the community that is there and for their actions.
I think that did you have a question, or do you have
to? Oh, I was just going to, I guess I must be the stupidest person who walks the earth, because I can't comprehend that there is anybody in any way associated with Mormonism who thinks this would have been a good, smart, funny, good idea. I mean,
there was a lot, and so that's why I want to hear.
And I think that the key word here is intention. It doesn't matter what their intention was. The trauma was there. I was in an argument the day after it with another group of prominent progressive Mormons, and some were active, some were not, and all had huge connections to this community. And the reality was, is they were like, but it wasn't intended to be that, so we got to go with that. And it was discounting anyone's lived experiences, and it wasn't until you turned it back on them. So I said, well, you've been advocating strategically for the LGBTQ community for 20 years, you know, politically, socially, within the church, with literally, like, this man had been in discussions with general authorities. And I'm like, all of that, if someone had come in and done this to you and what your purpose was, what would that have done? And when I flip it back, my history is with ordained women. And every single statement we made was strategic. Every single letter that was sent was strategic and looked over by a team of 30 people. And the Black community does that same thing in a million ways, especially that month when they were surrounded by the NAACP and doing the action to celebrate the anniversary. So this was a community that was making a lot of progress internally, strategically and on purpose. And if someone had come out and put out a statement for, oh, by the way, women are ordained and we're ordaining someone tomorrow and da-da-da, and everyone had believed them, it would have been a man that had done it. And white man that had done it, right? Like, and we all would have, everyone would have been upset by that. But I have seen, and I truly believe that, I believe that it's because it was people of color that they were like, but our intentions.
Right,
and
I think and it
that
brings
that
up,
needs to be addressed.
It brings up intent versus impact. So HR 101, getting any HR training around sexual harassment, particularly, it doesn't matter what your intention was. Well, I didn't intend for you to be offended by my sexually harassing comment or joke. Well, the impact of it was that I was harassed or assaulted or whatever else happened. So intention is not as significant as the impact, right? Do they both matter? Sure. They both get to exist in the context of the conversation, but what we need to examine is the impact. And my goal is to, I don't really care about Jonathan Streeter. I don't. To me, he's insignificant so much that I forgot his damn last name. My intention is that if that comes out, if that sort of that conversation goes organically, okay. But my goal isn't to talk about who's that, because that's, again, putting it
on someone else.
And it's our community. It's us. It's all of us. And so I want us to have a dialogue where we look at ourselves and we say, how have I contributed to this dynamic, to our racial divide in this community? Because it's happened. And we want to try to figure that out and move forward and be better. And so other reactions that people saw or, yeah.
So just a question that I'm curious about. So I've been plugged into, I write about Blacks and Mormons, and I've been plugged into activism. I've seen white activists in the church. I've seen Black activists in the church. So I'm pretty aware of what some folks are doing behind the scenes. But I think one or both of you referred to that there's stuff going on, and I want you to just comment on that for a minute, if you wouldn't mind. And correct me if I'm wrong, I see B1 as part of this. I know there's some politics behind that I'm not aware of, but I know that it's there. So I'm wondering if you can talk about the B1 politics and also some other activities that Black Latter-day Saints are doing to push this conversation forward with the church hierarchy.
So I can talk about that. I don't know that it's... we don't want to get too far off of where we're going, but there's a lot happening, and it's been happening. Genesis has existed. There was a Black, white, and Mormon conference. They've had two now, 2 years in a row, the University of Utah. people have been writing about this stuff for years. I've been writing and talking about it for years, in having these conversations. And there was a conference in D.C. that was held and were organized by Black women to talk about race in the church. So the activism happens. There's feet on the ground who have conversations at the highest levels, and there's also conversations being had here. And we're now having a conversation. And so it's important, I think, for us to find where's our place, each of us. I know where my place is. My place is, it's not my job to dismantle white supremacy in the church. That's not my job. That's white people's job. My job is to help my community heal. And as a friend to this community, I'm willing to have this conversation with you guys. There really aren't that many of us who will do it. And most of my Black friends, who are the prominent people that you see out doing all the actions, are like, we are done. We're done with these Mormon feminists. We are done with these white liberal Mormons. We're done. You have hurt us more than the church could ever hurt us because you've said you're on our side. And time again, you show that you're not. And I get flack for being here. I've lost friends for continuing to show up in these spaces and have these conversations. So I really hope today we can reflect and say, like, how have I been a part of this as a problem, and how can I do better? Mark, did you have
No, I'll start off with a confession. I don't remember it super well, but I remember Joanna, like, telling me that this thing had come out or whatever. And then it was a hoax. And so my initial reaction was this sort of like, you know, the church has done all these things and I have all this animosity and, you know, good for them. They got them good, you know. And that was actually my first reaction. And then
got the church good. Like, they sure showed the church. They hurt the church.
They hurt the church, okay. Yeah. You know, like, got them, you know. But I think Joanne had been talking to you. And pretty soon it hit, you know, the realization came. Well, yeah, but there are all these people who are just devastated by it. And it, you know, took me a few minutes then, to really understand, like, the hurt and everything that was going on. But I do have to admit to that, like, first initial reaction.
And I appreciate you leaning into that, because it's not so much the first reaction, it's then what's the process, then what? What's the next reaction, right? What's the second reaction? Where do you reach out to your trusted friend and go, maybe I need more to this. I should bounce this off of someone. Maybe not your only Black friend, but we should bounce this off of someone. Like, okay, my friend's really connected with what's going on. I have this person on my social media. Hey, I felt funky about this, what did you think about this, right?
Well, just one of the things that's kind of resonating with me throughout this conversation is just that white people in this situation, like, need to learn to meet people in their grief and not, like, try to push their agenda over where somebody is with their experience, because I think that's a lot of what I'm going to cry. I didn't participate in this discussion at all because I was shocked. Like, the whole thing, it happened so quickly. I saw the link, and I'll be honest, I haven't even clicked on it because I saw it, and then it was, like, 20 minutes later that it was like, oh, haha, it's a joke, and then I start seeing all this stuff roll in, and it just seemed like everybody was so quick to make their point, to say what it was that they felt this was about, and to even tell Black Mormons, like, I see your grief, but you don't understand what you're really grieving. Like, I need to tell you what your grief is about. Your grief is about exclusion and the church this and the church that, and we're your friends. We're the ones who are going to make this happen. Like, it's like, who are you, Elder Price? I mean, come on. Like, give me a break. That's just some racist. I mean, I have some words that probably aren't appropriate for a family environment. But anyway, the point is, like, I just feel like you have to meet people and just listen. You know, just hear. And the other thing in pushing people's agenda, their own agenda, that I saw from a lot of white people was just like, oh, I found a Black person who agrees with my agenda. And this was something that Andrew pointed to, and he said, I don't know if we're going to go there. And I'm not going to name any names because I don't think that's what this is about. You know, this is about white people trying to push their agenda and being like, oh, yeah, I mean, I've got, like, literally, you know, almost all the Black Mormons I know are saying this is, like, awful. But I found, like, one person who agrees with me and who thinks this was strategic. And, like, so I'm going to be like, well, I agree with this person. And that's totally valid because he's a Black person, therefore. Like, it's not about that. You know, it's not about our agenda. It's, like,
now, so I said this comment yesterday in the FMH panel, but I think a lot of times, as much as Mormons, we covenant during our baptismal covenants that we will mourn with those who mourn and comfort those who stand in need of comfort, we're also pioneers, right? Like, we put our shoulder to the wheel and we keep pushing and we see somebody who's sad and we bring them a meal and we fix things. But we never covenant to fix anything or anyone. And as a community, we just aren't very good at living our baptismal covenant, because that pioneer drive to fix things and to make it better and to get rid of that contention, because that's of the devil, right? That we need to fix it so that we don't have to mourn. So we don't have to comfort, Because if we can make something better, then I don't need to mourn with you because you're done mourning, right? And I think that that is a lot of times our impulse, particularly in the white community, in the progressive Mormon community, is that we want to say, I didn't do that. Instead of just sitting with Misha and saying, that was really heavy. And so I think that's part of what Misha wants us, you know, to talk about today. And I want us to make sure that, you know, we are holding ourselves accountable, because even here in this room, I know we are probably likely going to want to say, like, well, I felt this way about it. This was my reaction. Like, I wasn't one of those. So I think it's really important that we bring up, like, you know what? No, I did have that first reaction of, like, we showed the church. Because I think even in our discussions, it's really easy to be like, no, I'm one of the good ones. And when we break this down, when we deconstruct this white supremacy, we have to realize that it's not a matter of good versus bad. It is a matter of a system that all of us contribute to and participate in, and many of us benefit from. And so recognizing that it's not us sitting here giving ourselves a pat on the back, like, we were one of the good ones. It is saying, I still benefit from the system. I was able to not open it up, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, really.
Right. I was able to not open it up.
Yeah.
I was able to not feel that grief. I was able to take a step back and say, like, I don't really remember when it happened or what was going on, because it wasn't my grief and it wasn't my story. So how do we here recognize those ways that we are privileged even in our interactions and even in the ways that we support the Black community? that we are able to do that.
So I do want to make it personal, at least for me. I'm mom to many kids. Two of them are black. And when we were looking to adopt them, I remember the social worker saying, well, you know what it means to bring a black child into Mormon Utah. And I said, oh, yeah, I know what that means. I really didn't. And about 4 years ago, with them being 7 and 10, somebody posted the Harvard implicit bias test, where I don't remember exactly how it works, but basically their pictures flashed and it can identify your implicit bias for or against certain groups of people. And it looks at subconscious, not conscious thought. And I thought, I am going to ace this. I have two black children. I am not biased. And I can't tell you the shame that I felt then and the shame that I still feel now when the results came that I am implicitly biased against two of my children that I love and adore. And I think the problem often comes in people saying, it's not me, I'm not biased. I have spent the last 11 years trying to overcome the implicit bias that has been forced into me. And that's been done by reading book after book, by talking to people, by admitting my inability to overcome the societal constructs that shaped me in a way that I am privileged. And my knee-jerk reaction is not just.
So, I don't know. I'm a nerd at the end of the day, so I'll get a little historical. Mormons weren't always white. How many knew that? Okay. Mormons weren't always white. Mormons were considered another race. And if you want to know more the intricacies of that, read Paul Rees' book. Which is, at first I was like, I'm not, this is some crazy stuff. As a black person, I was like, this is nuts. I was like, come on now. Come on now, Paul. Really, I think it unfolds so accurately that... So Mormons were actually inspected, and a doctor came and was like, I don't know what they are. They're some type of humanoid, but they have different, their skin is different, and their heads are different. And no, he didn't say horns in his medical report, but he said all these physical features, right, that made Mormons not white. And Mormons needed to be white real bad because... Mormons were at odds with mainstream Protestantism. And people often think that Mormons were excluded for polygamy. People didn't like polygamy. They didn't understand it. But the idea that potentially your child, your daughter, would be the same status as a black or brown person was so horrifying that the story of Mormonism has always been one that's been racialized. It was the intermarrying. They knew they baptized blacks and browns. They have black and brown leaders in their church. They practice polygamy and they intermarry. That could mean they could come and my daughter would be the same as a slave? I think not. That's not going to happen. Right? But we've rewritten the narrative to make it just about people didn't like polygamy. Not true. People didn't like people of color. White people didn't like people of color. White people didn't like black people. White people didn't like indigenous people. And black people were sold in the deal for Mormonism's whiteness. We were sold, and the price was our priesthood authority. That is what was stripped. Because black men were ordained to the priesthood by Joseph Smith. They did preach to white congregations. The only only church in America that had a black preacher preaching to a white audience. It's Mormons. We were progressive when it came to race. And now, was Joseph Smith perfect? No.
Oh, we're not here.
No.
Oh.
Not even on race, right?
He's moderating.
He had varying statements that were oppositional to each other. You know, he said, well, there shouldn't be slaves, but if you have them, you can't tell someone how to treat them. I mean, I hope they treat them nice, but I can't tell a man what to do with his own property. So, not great. But he's over here, and he's doing his thing, right? He's doing his thing. He's baptizing, and he's ordaining, and people are being baptized and ordained by black preachers. Kubrick Lewis and the like. And in order to get the violence to stop, to become accepted, we had to become extremely racist. We had to become the most racist. We will strip you of your authority. Now, this wasn't an idea. This wasn't like, oh, for the black people that may join the church, I don't know. These are actual real people who are ordained. These are real black people who are sitting in congregations who no longer can practice with any authority in their church that they're helping to build. Right?
Baptized, and then like next week you can't baptize.
Right.
Like, that's the
extreme. And guess what? Mormons are white now, right? Even though we're a global church, the face of our church is Mitt Romney. It's pretty, you don't get whiter than that guy. Right? Just a picture. People still ask me, I didn't know Mormons were allowed to be black Mormons. I get that all the time. They're black Mormons? What? All over the world, yeah. And so we need to understand our history. That we have always been the butt of the joke, the price that's been paid. Black Mormons. And for some of us, we find our spiritual home here. For whatever reason, if God told you to do something, I'm not going to tell you God told you he didn't tell you that. Because most of the black Mormons that are very active that I know, when I say, why are you, they're like, because God told me to be. And I'm like, well, I can't argue with that. I can't argue with God. God told you to be here. So my Mormonism will always be in trying, what makes me Mormon is me wanting to see the church do better. Me wanting to see that my black friends and family that are so dedicated, because God told me to be there, have a place to be. And when or if they leave, that they will also have a place to be, because that place is here. This is that place. Because when you, again, like I said at the beginning, anything you do as a black person, you either are connecting to the community or you're disconnecting from the community. When a black Mormon leaves the church, you lose your black Mormon community sometimes. What community then do you have? You have an ex-Mormon community. And if that community isn't safe, then you have no one. And if that's where you want to be, because that's only people that understand a little bit of your story or your struggle, but there's not a space for you because it was so funny or because your grief doesn't matter. And yet, I have sat many times with my white friends when they're having a faith crisis, and they've cried. And I say, I feel you. I know what it's like to be in the valley. I don't know what it's like to be on top of the cliff, because I'm black, never been there. But I know what it's like to be in the valley, and I think the valley is where God lives. So come on down. Come on down with me. It's fine. The water's fine down here. We're okay down here. I don't understand all the intricacies of a white faith crisis because I'm not white. I've never been promised that I'm not a white man. I've never been promised that I would be God. And to lose that, I don't know what that's like other than I see the grief. And I hear it every time I go to Sunstone. And I hear it every time I'm in therapy with the next Mormon. And I sit with people in their grief all the time about that. it's not something that I can relate to 100%, but I can see someone's pain, and I can sit with them in it, and I can say, you know what, you don't even have to help me understand. Like, I'm just here, and it's heavy. This is heavy, right? And that's what I'm asking, is to be seen and valued and not sold. Because again, we were sold again. That's traumatic. We've been sold a lot. It's traumatic to be sold. And I get it. We're expendable. We always have been. But what I want each of you to say is, you're not expendable to me. And every single black person that you meet or brown person you meet in the church, you're not expendable to me. And I know y'all know how to do it, because people have not stepped foot back in a church after the exclusion policy came. People have had tough conversations with their families that they've never thought they would have over the exclusion policy. I've seen it. I've seen this community rally behind marginalized people and say, enough is enough, and I'll be here with you. I'll be outside of the church with you. Since you can't be in the church, I'll be outside of the church with you. I've seen you all do it. So I know you're capable. I just want us to be to be seen and valued. And like that's the point of today. Like this really, I didn't want to come and be like, I'm gonna go and lecture white people and tell them they're racist. I came in a little bit. But I wanted this not to be a calling out, but a calling in. A calling into conversation, a calling into dialogue, a calling into us seeing each other. And for us to believe that black and brown people are not expendable. And we know they are to the church, right? But to say, each of us individually, they're not expendable to me. I'm better with my black and brown friends in my life. My church is better with them here. My ex-Mormon oasis camp or whatever is better with them here, right? Wherever you are in your faith journey.
You know a black person's not going camping, right?
Yeah, we not. We're not. But we're different. But wherever, for each of you to say, no, like, this matters. And that doesn't mean that you're not going to have the first thought. It matters what the second thought is. And that's what I want to talk about today, is how do we get to that second thought?
Go ahead. I love that you brought up, like, our history, because I think that the more we can be like, oh, you can say like, hey, I learned this, right? Like we've learned racism. We have learned it in primary songs. We have learned this. So if we can understand that, and like for me, it's been very hard to be like, oh, so like we were talking, a group of us around a table, about like our modesty voice, like it's an inner voice that like is in our head all the time, and even if we've let go of that, it's still in our head. We can sit around and talk about that and be like, when's that gonna go away? But why can't we talk about the racism voice in our head? Like that should be allowed to be discussed, and it's harder to discuss that. To be like, oh yeah, I have like an inner voice in my head that's telling me X, Y, and Z. Or, oh, I hear this stupid scripture in my head. And I think that acknowledging that history kind of makes it easier to go to the quicksand a little and acknowledge where we might have messed up.
I'm a little obtuse, but I don't ever recall singing anything about racism in primary.
What?
I mean, I think we could go there too.
Well, I'd like to, because I feel that those things have taught me to be just the opposite of what you're saying. But maybe, like I say, I'm obtuse.
Yeah, I think that to some people it's obvious, and to some it's hidden. So you feel free to interrupt me if I'm not correcting there, but I remember when I, on my search for feminism and searching for the feminine divine, I went through the hymn book, looking for me. No, I know. I'm getting there. I went through the hymn book looking for me, and I went through the primary book looking for
moments of a female divine. And I found them all of 12 times in one place and like 7 times in another. I would challenge you to go through the hymn book and the primary book looking for a, no, I challenge you to look through those and to say, where is a person of color leader? Where is someone that looks like her? Where is someone that is leading like him? Where are they in our places? And if they're there, how are they being portrayed? Because in one version of the primary hymn book, the wise men and the foolish men are pictured, and one of them is white and one of them is brown.
Okay, I'm going to make this as fast as I can. I'm 70 years old, born and raised in San Francisco, went to church in San Francisco, the LDS Church. Intellectually, I know all this stuff. I graduated in history. I've taken classes at the university the last 5 or 6 years, Paul's class, race and gender and all of this business. Intellectually, I am totally 100% on board. I want to know what, and I'm not trying to be a smart aleck, I want to know what do people expect for me to do in a practical sense. I do not know. I've lived in Washington, D.C. I've lived in Seattle for many, many years, grew up in San Francisco. You know, I've associated with lots of people of color, not in the church much. Okay, I live in West Jordan. That is not the bastion of mixed race people. So, I don't know what I'm supposed to be, when I say supposed to, what, you know, you are recommending that I personally do. I'm not as progressive as I am. You know, I've subscribed to Sunstone magazine, you know, for 40 years. I've gone to these symposiums. I was at the 1979 one. I've been to almost every single one. So, I mean, I don't write to the church and tell them you need to ordain women. I don't write to the church and tell them you need to change your policy on transgender people and LGBTQ people. I don't write to the church and say you need to do this and that and the other.
So
that's
so
not me.
We're gonna get there.
Okay.
We're gonna get there.
But
we're not gonna rush the process, because the first step is we have to sit with this discomfort. We have to sit with this discomfort. The discomfort that's arising, that where you want to get to fix it.
Yeah.
Tell them what to do.
I've
been sitting with this discomfort for 3 decades. I'm pretty patient. So. Right. And I think we're going to get to a place where we generate some of that stuff. But I think, like, so if you were to sit with your discomfort, right, and you were to reflect, I would say that one thing that I observed, since you asked the question, I'll answer it. One thing that I observed is your shock. Your shock spoke to me, because why would anyone think, and you had many people telling you, this is what a lot of people thought and felt. And so being shocked by the response of other white people, that's something you can actually analyze and go, maybe I shouldn't be shocked when white people do stuff that's racist, because that's what we've been taught to do, right? So, like, don't be shocked, because when you're shocked about violence that happens to me in my community, I feel disconnected, because I'm like, that's the way privilege works. It's put you in such a category that you could be so shocked. The shock and the awe that white liberal people felt at the election, the shock particularly I'm talking about, was actually really interesting to black people. Because black people were like, yeah, we knew this was going to happen. And black people turned out and voted in numbers that are, I mean, we can get into the stats. We should all know them, right? We're not shocked when racist stuff happens. We're not shocked when people are oppressed. We're not shocked when there's violence to people who have always been for sale. And so your shock, I would say, is a reflection of your privilege and is you embodying it, right? And so one, I would say, if you hear something, someone saying this happened, don't be shocked, right? Your first thought can be, oh, wow. And then say, what's next? What's my next thought? So that's a number one. First thing to do is to say, all right, I had my first thought. What's next? Maybe I shouldn't be shocked when people mess up and do stuff that they've been conditioned to do, right? Maybe I shouldn't be shocked when there's violence. Maybe I shouldn't be shocked when, I don't know, a man commits sexual assault. I can be disturbed. I can be disgusted. I can be angry. Maybe being shocked and surprised by that is like really diminishing to the experience of women, that that's just our daily existence, right? But again, I think we're going to be able to generate some things, because I do want you to have tangible things to leave with, but I do want us to also be able to sit here for a minute with this. Is there any other thoughts? Go ahead.
Because I actually did use that exact word, that I was shocked and that I couldn't say anything in the entire discussion, and that I watched like the progressive Mormon internet like burn down for days, for like a week over this, and it felt like a flood of white voices. And so I thought, I have nothing to add to this discussion. You know, but like you say, that's privilege of me just saying like, well, look at all these white people who have tons of opinions about black people's grief. Like, maybe I should just shut up and not say anything. Because I can, and
we shouldn't. But it's not black people's jobs to be like telling us the list of what to do either. Like, it's not right. Our black brothers and sisters' job to be like, I'm here and I'm in the church, and all I'm going to do is list out all the ways that I need you here for me.
But if we don't dialogue together, we're going to go for the next way, years, generations after.
I agree. Right. To be addressed.
Right. No, wait. Right, no, absolutely. What we're talking about, though, is not asking the person who is unconscious on the floor and not breathing to give CPR instructions, right? We're asking the person who's bleeding out to just be able to bleed, and we, you know, but that's the thing. Right, but the thing is that we're saying, no, it's not okay to ask the person who's bleeding out to give instructions on how to tie a tourniquet.
Okay, then let me ask you.
Great, okay, so I have two children who I adopted from foster care who are Native. And that's a super...
No.
First off, I would never recommend a white person adopt children of color. But, I mean, my case, my children would have lived in the hospital and have been separated. And so as a person who is able to take care of them, I did. And I do. I will tell you, though, that there are things that happen every single day. And they are young. They are 5 and 6 years old. They have a lifetime of racial identity and Native identity and being raised in a white home and living in a white society that is going to be complicated. But already at 5, my youngest, and I am a fairly progressive individual, my youngest will come up to me and say, I want skin like yours. And I can't fix that. I have to sit there with my 5-year-old and say, yeah. But that, even that, is fixing it, right? Is telling them, you feel this way, but you shouldn't. And that's what we did in the progressive community when this hoax came out, and we said, no, you guys are mad at the wrong person. You should be mad at the church. You should be this. We sat there And we tried to fix it, and we tried to tell them better, right? We need to be able to sit in that discomfort.
I think it might be useful to talk about all of the ways that racism can function, because we often think about racism as like a really stereotyping in the negative. But racism can also stereotype in ways that we think is positive and helpful, but it's still racism against a group of people. Could we maybe talk? I think that might be helpful a little bit to talk, like.
And we've only got 20 minutes, so it'd be a good idea.
Yes. Yeah, do you know what I'm trying to say, Misha?
Remind me of your name.
I would never told you it's Beverly.
Beverly.
Yes.
Can you tell me about your urgency?
Well,
can you tell me about it? I want to hear about it because I want to understand better where you're coming from.
The urgency is because I would like to genuinely understand, and that's what I'm trying to do. And I'm not generally an offensive person, but I get all of this sense that nothing I'm going to
I would love for people to speak, and we're not going to have a solution by the time this is done.
No,
my main goal is to sit with this discomfort. You're feeling it, which is why you referred to yourself as saying you were feeling defensive, and that comes from being yourself. You're protecting yourself because you're feeling uncomfortable. And what I want you to know is. Yeah.
It's really our turn to be uncomfortable.
I've been uncomfortable for 30 years.
Okay,
and I show up. And so the discomfort's okay.
Okay. I do kind of have to, because one thing I see in a lot of conversation with allies is this idea of we need to be treated with kid gloves and given kind of an idea of how we can fix this, which we're trying to say part of this is realizing it can't be fixed, and part of it is realizing that the best thing you can do is sit in discomfort and not try to figure out what is the thing you can do to save the day, right? Part of this is to, when you're sitting in discomfort, you're realizing the helplessness that we already have experienced. Because when you're in fix-it solution, you're still thinking, well, okay, this helplessness that you can fix is just because there's something that I need to be doing for you, and so you can tell me or you can lead me to the resources that to help that. But part of this is really that still is not looking at the problem deeply enough. Our problem is still deeper than that. Now, I do kind of want to go a little bit against Nisha. She's going to like kill me after this. I want to, because I, like you, am someone who wants to fix things, right? And so for me, part of the thing that I have to do when I go into, say, feminist spaces is I have to sit there and say, when I get the impression as a man, and I'm hearing all these stories, and I think this is horrible, and I am shocked because I don't experience this day to day. And it's really tough to sit in that space and think, what can I do? Can I, be guarding you every day and trying to beat people up who are going to say or do horrible things? Do I need to try to be your bodyguard? Do I need to try to speak up for you? And the answer, because sometimes the thing is, like, I'll be in a conversation, and a woman will say something. It gets ignored. I will say the same exact thing, and then all of a sudden, right? And that's still the problem. That's still part of the problem, right? And so this idea, then, is of I understand that you want something that you can do, and but what I see over and over then, this happens, is people with good intentions who are trying to use their privilege and good, and they're trying to get a solution for that, it then becomes this thing of, well, I've been effective doing this, and so I think that I'm going to keep on going my own way, and then inevitably, in all these situations, the allies turn it into something that's about them. And I think that what we're trying to do is, I really love when allies want to do stuff, but the thing is, we're trying to sit and say, at the end of the day, if someone is saying, the way that you can help is by sitting in your discomfort, that is it. And I understand there's this idea here of, well, I showed up. And if I don't get the answers that I'm feeling for, that I can feel like I'm moving the conversation forward, I'm feeling like I can help solve this, I have seen people say things like, well, then I'm going to not participate anymore. Because I tried to help, and it blew up in my face. And I'm seeing that. I'm seeing that, and I understand that. But from my perspective, it looks like if your participation is that you want or you feel the need to have answers that make sense to you and that satisfy you, that you can feel like you're doing something to kind of help solve the issue, that doesn't give me confidence. And I mean, I don't have a lot of confidence anyway because I experience this every day, but it doesn't give me a lot of confidence. And I don't know how to change the perspective. I don't know how to change the mindset. And so like for me, like personally, I'm like, I agree with people who give up on allies. I agree with, yeah, I understand that idea because there's this cycle that keeps on happening. And I don't know how to say it in any other way that even if we try to give you a series of steps that you can try to do.
That's not at all what I'm saying. I'm saying that for all my years, I went to the program of the B1 conference the night that Darius spoke and others. I've heard Darius speak many times. I go whenever he speaks. My other LDS friends, who obviously are white people, they don't even know there's any kind of a problem. They don't give a shit about this stuff. At least, and I'm not trying to get people patting me on the back and said, oh, nice liberal whitey, you're trying to help people.
So you could tell them, right? I mean, I guess that's something to do, right?
Interject really quickly. I think one thing that we have here is that we have two individuals who are gracious enough to come here and share their experience with us. No, but I'm hearing a lot of our experiences superimposed over theirs instead of us just believing them. No, but there's a lot of pushback happening right now when they're saying, like, just sit with it. And maybe there isn't a perfect answer for a question. And maybe, no, and so we're just sitting. And maybe it's not exactly what you want, but it's exactly what they're asking. And I also
gave another suggestion, which has been kind of forgotten already, which was have your first thought and then challenge it with another thought. That is something you can do. That's very tangible. Okay, I see this thing that's happening in front of me. Let me check it out. Let me examine it. We all are really good at that. This is a room full of smart people. This is a room full of people who have done that with church material. You really understood and could relate to what George was saying about the women, right? You really, it's very similar. It's very similar, right? So we all have experience with doing this. I've studied racism for a long time. I write about it academically. I live it. I also have a PhD where that's what my PhD dissertation has been on. And people pay me a lot of money to come and facilitate conversations like this. And I paid to come here and facilitate this conversation because I really care about this community. I really care. Probably shouldn't, because it's not really in my best interest. What I'm saying is, see what happened. This fake apology. Why? Understand why would that be a problem, and understand why we were going to have a celebration. We were going to talk about 40 years of the priesthood restoration, and we can't until we can't really celebrate together and be one until we can really see and hear and understand each other. And that's what I'm asking us to reflect on, is to sit with the discomfort of what people that share your white identity did, what we all do to each other and the ways that we hurt each other, acknowledge it, and then learn to challenge our thoughts and to check it out with a friend. So now we're all here, we're all connected. I would hope that some of you that maybe have connected today would exchange at each other on Facebook. And this is a room full of people. Anyone who sends me a Facebook request, I will accept. And you check it out with me. Send me an article. And I was just going to mention that. So that's another thing that I would hope that people would do. I was an advisor to the Shoulder to the Wheel project. How many have heard of that? Okay, so Shoulder to the Wheel is a document that is a workbook essentially around race issues in the church. It's a really great resource. It's called is it shouldertothewheel.org? You Google it. We'll get you the exact name. I think that's a great place to start reading and to start thinking about these things. Start having these conversations. I appreciate that you've been in all these places that have these conversations, right? Continue to have them with your West Jordan friends, right? That's how you leverage that privilege. Leveraging your privilege first means recognizing that there's a problem, recognizing that you're a part of the problem, challenging your own implicit biases, as you heard about, and then figuring out how do I leverage my privilege where other people don't have access to the spaces that other... So if you go to church, you can leverage there. If you go to book club, you can leverage there. You can be the person that speaks up and says, hey, like, did you hear about what happened? I believe you. I want us to do something tactile. Can we all stand for a second? So everyone practice it. Step and shimmy to the side. Well, you might bump each other, but that's okay. Whatever side. Shimmy. Step. Shimmy. It's hard to
do. Oh, not shimmy.
Okay?
You guys are white,
step,
right?
Shimmy. Okay?
Shimmy.
And I want you to remember this step.
Do it at home.
Okay? And practice it. Obviously, you might be going into a space that's going to have a hard conversation. You could step into that space, literally get out of your car. Today, step,
don't know what to do anymore, get the hell out of Dodge. And be like the person who does know what they're doing, do it. Right? So that means that, we can all say, that means that you ask your bishop, you ask your bishop, hey, can we read the essay on racism in the church over the pulpit? Can we have a fifth Sunday on it?
I'm going to say, I teach gospel doctrine. Last year, I put the link up there. I didn't put it up. I printed it.
Yeah. Perfect. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. And you can keep asking that. Yes, sir.
There's nobody. I'm convinced 99%.
Hadn't heard of it.
Has never heard of it.
Yep.
Any of the gospel.
Exactly. Yes, sir.
I'd like to just say this much. I'm 85. I was probably 40 before I saw the very first person of any color in church. I'm much more liberal than most of my friends, but I'm super active in church. I don't think I've missed 10 times in 85 years, literally. But my friends, and I suppose myself, we've come a long, long way from where we started. We might be slow learners. We might be terribly awkward, over-friendly, over-anxious to make you feel like we're together. And maybe we overdo it or underdo it, or we don't know what's right or wrong. I look at my friends who are much more conservative. I know they care. They, some of them, I remember one who called and asked if I was going to leave the church when the priesthood change was made, which shocked me. But that individual is now, I think, on board. And so as you look at our faults and failures and inabilities to be as discreet and open and forward as we ought to be, consider where we came from. And this is
absolutely
a whole better church than it was 40 years ago.
You know what? In so many ways, I'm not 85. I'm not 85. I'll probably be 85 one day. And it matters. It matters. The progress. It matters. And we get to look back at our progress, and we get to feel good about it. Nothing wrong with that, at all. I appreciate what, you know, my grandparents have done in the church to make it safer and better for me. They've had conversations, and they're pretty racist, but they've had conversations because I exist that I would have never thought they would have ever had. And that's what I'm saying is, yes, but we can always do more, and we can always push forward, or we can continue to do the things that we're doing. And it's by saying, we got to read this essay. And it's by saying, when you hear about this thing come up, yeah, it was a problem. Because it matters that for 85 years, you have been a person who's become safer and safer and safer for us, if we so choose to be in the pews next to you. That matters. It does. Do not get me wrong on that. It matters. And also, like, our salvation is dependent on each other. If you're Mormon and you believe in Mormon theology, we're getting there together. It takes all of us. My salvation is dependent on you, and yours is on mine. So we got to collaborate. We want to be one,
But we need to celebrate the fact that we are different, and we also have to look at the ways in which our differences have hurt each other, right? And patriarchy hurts women, and racism hurts black people. And the flip side of that is white people benefit from that pain and that violence to me. And men benefit from that violence to women. And straight people benefit from the violence to the queer community, right? We have to be able to look at both sides of that. And so I appreciate that everyone is here in the room today, and you've started having a conversation. And I know it's a little uncomfortable, right? I get that. And I'm saying, I really get it, right? I've been sitting with it. And I'm glad that for a moment you guys came and you sat with me. Because you didn't think that. You thought I was going to get up and talk about. And Lindsay knew this. I told Lindsay, we can't have a celebration. I can't do it. I'm really hurting. We got to have a tough conversation. She was like, okay. So you're gonna false advertise? And I said, yeah. She said, okay, I trust you. Because you have so much experience having these conversations and doing this work, I trust you. And so I appreciate you, and I hope that you all remember your step up and shimmy to the side dance moves, and you'll practice them, and that you'll challenge that first thought with a second thought, and that you now have a network of people, right, that you can connect with. And if you see something funky online or you hear about something, check it out. Check it out. And thank you for listening, for sitting with the discomfort. I know that it's hard. I really do. I get it. But I appreciate you that you came here vulnerable, and I appreciate that you spoke up. Because I know that other people are feeling that same way. And that's okay. We are where we are, and we have places to go. We are where we are, and we have places to go. And I think we have to go out of this room, I think.
You have two.
Let me say this. To end. We can't fix the big stuff. No one person is going to change white supremacy. No one person is going to dismantle patriarchy. But we can each become a safer person. I don't really believe in safe spaces. People will say, can we have a safe space? And I'm like, I don't believe that exists. But what we can work on is how do we become a safe person so that anyone that's with us, we're not doing violence on. And sometimes even our defensiveness or our shock or our those things that seem pretty harmless can actually be unsafe and create unsafety for someone that's vulnerable. And so it's about challenging those things. And so I think our goal collectively, I hope, is that each of us can become a safer person. And I work on it with a lot of things. I'm a cis straight woman, right? So I have to work on how I sit with my queer friends all the time. There's things that come up and I have to go, okay, all right, I can do better. I can be safer for you. I can be safer for you. Sometimes that means speaking up, and sometimes that means shutting up. I have to, you have to fill it out and figure out what's the best response for the context. But I love Sunstone. I flew in from New York. I love Sunstone. I'll always come to Sunstone. As long as I'm able, I'll come. And I'll be here and I'll share in this. And so I appreciate that you're here. And I hope that you'll continue to learn and to grow and read Shoulder to the Wheel, by Decolonizing Mormonism, the book. I have a chapter in the book that helps us to understand our story a little bit more, our collective story. And I want you to also be able to see yourselves in the stories of your black and brown friends and congregants, right? Because we need each other, and we need to see each other. And we need to be able to see ourselves in each other, right? So anyway, thank you for coming. And I hope the rest of your sunstone is fun stone.